Well, howdy there, stranger. I'm Jordy.
And I'm Brad.
And welcome back to Beers with Queers, the true crime podcast where I research a case, and Brad here, potentially you guys,
don't know a damn thing about it.
So just a quick life update on our end before we get into today's case. We are heading to Washington, D.C. here in a few days to spend a week just checking out all the museums and historic landmarks. So this is kind of a call for anyone who is familiar with D.C. to send us all of your recommendations. Best places to eat, the museums and sites that are a must-see when we're there, things we need to check out, the best queer bars to check out if you know of any. You know, we want to make sure we get the full experience, so please shoot us a message with all your recommendations, and we'll love you forever for it. Because I'm actually kind of truly excited to experience DC fully, because I did not have such a great experience the last time we went. You know, last year we spent a few days there while waiting to go to Iceland, and it was fun up until my car got towed, even though I 100% made sure I could park it where I did. So, but they towed it literally 10 feet up the street and then gave me a ticket, so I was a little bit PO'd.
DC's a lot of fun as long as you don't have to drive in it.
Yeah, so I'm excited not to be driving in it this time, you know, lesson learned. But all that to say, again, let us know what we need to do while we're there over on our socials, on Instagram at Beers with Queers Pod, that's P-O-D, or on Facebook at Beers with Queers. And also, before we get into today's case, a huge shout out to one of our listeners for suggesting it to us in the first place. So I don't know if they're comfortable with me saying their name on the podcast, but a listener of ours over in the UK actually sent us a message on Instagram a few weeks ago suggesting this case and giving me kind of the lowdown on all the details. And it immediately drew me in because it was such a tragic and bizarre case. So thank you for the suggestion and bringing this case to our attention. Because I had never heard of it before they suggested it, and I don't honestly think it's been covered by a lot of podcasts. And so thank you for that. That was really awesome. Thank you for the suggestion. And we've actually had a few people suggest some cases, and I want all y'all to know that all those are coming soon. And I want y'all to know that the reason they haven't already come is because I usually like to try and collect as much info as I can to kind of fill out an hour worth of us talking about it. Because we do want to be thorough, we want to be as detailed as possible. So anyone who suggested a case, all those are coming. And if you do have a suggestion for a case, or just a case that you really want to hear us cover, again, shoot us a message over on our socials and tell us what you want us to cover.
And we really do appreciate that.
Absolutely. I love hearing from you guys. It fills me with so much joy. And it just makes this podcast even more enjoyable to do, just hearing your guys' thoughts. And you know, it doesn't have to be positive. I can take negative criticism. So no matter what your thoughts are, we would love to hear it. So with that, let's get into today's case, because today we are covering the case of Ben Field and the tragic murder of Peter Farquhar. So on October 26, 2015, in the area of Maids Morton, Buckinghamshire in the UK, a cleaner has arrived at the home of 69-year-old retired English professor Peter Farquhar. Now, as she entered the home, she saw Peter sitting on the couch. After receiving no response upon greeting him, she moved closer into the living room and noticed an empty bottle of whiskey resting by Peter's lap. Now, at first thinking he may be asleep, she tried to wake him, but upon touching him, found that he was stiff and cold. Realizing that something was wrong, she quickly dialed 999, which of course is the UK's version of 911. Police arrived at the scene to find that Peter was in fact deceased, and his family was contacted to inform them of the tragic news. Now, as his brother Ian Farquhar rushed to the house to find out what happened to his brother, he was greeted by officers and paramedics, but also 25-year-old Ben Field. Ben was no stranger to Ian, as Ben was actually Peter's partner and had been for several years at this point. So Ben directed Ian into the living room where Peter's body still sat, slightly slumped over the arm of the couch. Now, as Peter's body was being loaded up into an ambulance to take in for an autopsy, Ian was left confused as to what could have possibly happened. Now, he overheard Ben telling the officers at the scene that Peter did have a known alcohol problem, which, as much as he hated to admit it, that did kind of seem to be the case over the last few months of Peter's life. Almost every time Ian saw his brother, he was slurring his words or stumbling around the house and always seemed to be losing or misplacing his keys or his wallet. Empty whiskey and wine bottles were often left lying around the house, and Ben would often confide in him about how stressful it was to care for Peter whenever he got into one of his quote-unquote drunken states. But even with the supposed evidence of Peter's alcoholism, something just didn't quite sit right with him. It wasn't like his brother to rely on alcohol. Nothing about it made sense, and he made it known to his wife and several close friends that something just felt off about the whole thing, as Peter just wasn't the kind of guy to get drunk. But even still, the coroner concluded his findings and stated that Peter's official cause of death was accidental from acute alcohol consumption. No foul play was suspected, and the case was closed. Peter was buried in a grave alongside his mother on November 19, 2015, in the cemetery located beside the church where he and Ben would often attend together. Now, as his family and friends began to try and deal with the sudden loss of Peter, one thing still remained. Peter's will. Now, Peter had updated his will several times over the last few years, with the final version stating that his house, which was estimated to be worth about £280,000 or $360,000 in American dollars, was to go to his partner, Ben Field, along with another additional £25,000. Now, as the will was settled, life began to move on, and Peter's family began attempting to accept Peter's tragic and sad loss, but again, something didn't quite sit right with them. But little did they know that it wouldn't be long before their instincts would prove to be correct, as one of the most sadistic and sinister plots in UK history was about to be revealed, and the true extent of Peter's death would come to light, and the world would finally see Ben Field for the true monster that he was. So now that we've set the scene, we need to go back and learn about the two biggest players in this case, which of course is Ben Field and Peter Farquhar. So let's start with Peter. Peter Anthony Scott Farquhar was born on January 3, 1946 in Edinburgh, Scotland, but moved with his family to England when he was young. His father was a physician, and from a very early age, it was clear that Peter had inherited his father's intellect and was said to be academically gifted from a young age. He eventually attended Latymer Upper School in London before going on to achieve a first-class degree in English at Churchill College in Cambridge. Now, Peter went on to become an English teacher, a position he held at various schools over 34 years. He started his teaching journey at Manchester Grammar School from 1970 to 1982 before moving on to the Stowe School, where he taught for 24 years from 1983 to 2004. Peter was beloved by his fellow teachers and students alike, with one colleague later stating, "He had an acute understanding of the problems of modern adolescent boys. He was like a second father to many people." An online obituary Peter had following his death also stated, "Peter was fragile, formal yet friendly, precise but not pedantic. He had an attractive warmth mixed with intellectual rigor. For many students, he inspired a lot of literature and poetry. He could spot people's potential and would then gently push them to fulfill it." But now, although he was known to be very warm and friendly in the classroom, he was also not afraid to let a student have it if they were being a shithead or trying to cause a disturbance, and he would immediately shut it down. And they never did it again. And that's kind of what you got to do. You got to kind of nip it in the butt before it gets too much. Now, Peter rose through the ranks of the English position and eventually became head of the English department before retiring in 2004. He lived a quiet and peaceful life in Maids Morton in a nice two-story home, and honestly, things seemed to have gone perfect for Peter, and they continued to get perfect. He had a long and decorated career in a field he was extremely passionate about. He had no known health problems or ailments, and now he was going to retire and he got to live out his golden years in peace. Now, there was one thing that haunted Peter throughout most of his life, and something that he struggled with for over 60 years. So although Peter was openly gay and out to his family and loved ones, and they all accepted him unconditionally, Peter struggled trying to balance the fact that he was gay with the fact that he was also extremely religious. So Peter was a very devout evangelical Christian throughout his life, and at one point even considered becoming a priest. His faith was very important to him. However, he felt that in order to truly serve his faith and remain quote-unquote pure, he must never give in to his homosexual desires, as his faith saw that as one of the greatest sins. So for that, Peter actually chose to remain celibate throughout his life, never being in any relationship or sexual encounter with other men or women. Now, for the most part, his love and passion for English was enough to satisfy him, and he was content with being alone.
That sounds very lonely.
It's very lonely, because following his retirement and his growing age, Peter began to realize that he was lonely and that he didn't want to die alone or die before he knew what it was like to be loved romantically by another human being. Which I think, of course, that's something we can all relate to. Everyone wants to be loved.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, one of the biggest desires in life is to be loved and to love someone else.
So he actually kept extensive journals throughout his life, and he wrote down his feelings and thoughts every day for almost 30 years. He often talked about how lonely life was becoming and how he had a quote-unquote black hole where emotional relationships should be in his life. Peter expressed these conflicted emotions with religion and homosexuality through writing, and he even wrote and published 3 different books on the subject. His second novel, Between Boy and Man, was actually semi-autobiographical and followed a school chaplain as they struggled to balance their Christian faith with their homosexual urges. Now, on top of that, one of his novels explored the struggle of being a much older man, surrounded by all these younger and beautiful gay men, and how to deal with the fear that your best years are behind you, and it may be too late to find someone to love you in your advanced age.
I mean, starting in your 60s has got to be scary.
Absolutely. Because, you know, it is sad, and I think that's a fear that, again, a lot of us have. Most people are afraid of getting older, and part of that is the fear that as we age, we become less, quote-unquote, desirable or attractive to people, or you feel like it's too late to find someone to love you. But again, remember, it is never too late.
It's never too late. But I also think one of the things you think about as you get older is that you want to have somebody around, and you want to be with somebody that you can help them and they can help you. And it's just kind of that safety feeling along with love.
It is. It's just one of those things you just want to be able to share in the experience with people, just the experience of life. And that's where, you know, feel so much for Peter, because he did seem like a genuinely amazing, gentle soul. And obviously it's a struggle, especially if you're very religious, but it is never too late to come out. It's never too late to find love. It is never too late to do whatever you want. So if you do have that fear, get it out of your head right now, because you can do whatever you want, no matter what the age. So Peter was really struggling at this point in his life. He really wanted to find someone to love and spend his final years with. Not wanting to give up teaching entirely, he took on the role of a guest lecturer from time to time at the University of Buckingham in 2007, and it was there that he would meet 20-year-old Ben Field. And also, I wanted, before we even get into it, when we talk about Ben Field, he is probably one of the most sadistic people we'll ever talk about. We talked about Robert Burdella last week, and he didn't claim as many victims as Robert Burdella, but he is on that same level.
That's scary, because Robert Burdella was a horrible case to even listen to.
So Peter and Ben met on April 2nd, 2011, when Ben became one of Peter's students at a lecture he was giving. Peter would write in his journal later that evening, "A pleasant enough group, if not very responsive yet, except for one clever and enthusiastic lad, Ben Field. He engages and helps to make things work. He is a delightful young man." So now let's pause for a moment and talk about Ben Field, because again, it's also very odd how Peter and Ben are like polar opposites of each other. So Ben Field was born on October 27th, 1990, to Enfield and Beverly Field, and he was raised in the town of Market Harbor in Leicestershire. He was the middle child with a brother and a sister, and the family lived a pretty comfortable life. His father was a Baptist minister, and his mother was a Democratic politician. The family was also deeply religious and would often host Bible studies in their backyard. But now, despite seeming to be well-rounded, neighbors would later state that the family was always very arrogant, and they all came off as aloof and acted as if they were better than everyone else, with one neighbor later stating that Ben's dad actually once compared himself to Jesus Christ. So that's pretty arrogant. Ben himself would later state that a lot of pressure was put on all the Field children to be high achievers and to accomplish great things. He described his home life and upbringing as being cold and emotionless, with more emphasis being placed on achievements than actual love. His parents raised him to act like he was the best, and that everyone else was beneath him, and that he needed to achieve his goals by any means necessary. But now, that is not to say that no one is blaming his parents for what he did later on, because Ben's actions are completely his own. But you can kind of see where his narcissism and his callousness came from. You know, partially because how he was raised, but also partially because he is a legit psychopath. So Ben would go on to attend Bishop Stafford School, and it was here that his true colors and personality began to make himself known, as he quickly gained a reputation amongst his classmates for being, quote-unquote, arrogant and obsessed with his own intellect. Ben was described as a loner all throughout school, and he preferred to spend his time alone, only attempting to socialize with his classmates whenever he wanted something out of them. The biggest example of this was, at one point, Ben was running for class president, and so all throughout the election, he was being super friendly and nice to his classmates, and he made several honestly genuine friendships with them. However, the minute he lost the election, he dropped all of them, and he returned to acting cold and callous towards them. When he wasn't being a dick to his classmates, he was often in the library studying and attempting to get smarter, often learning big words to intentionally slip them into conversations with people, just so he can try and prove how, quote-unquote, intellectually superior he was to them.
Sounds like an awesome guy.
Sounds like a great guy to have at parties. But also, honestly, I knew a few people like that in high school. And I can picture in my head right now, like, him learning those big words.
I know a few people like that now.
Yeah, I can think of one or two. But he gained a reputation for constantly talking down to not only his classmates, but also his teachers, often interrupting them and trying to correct them on everything. Several of his teachers would later state that although Ben was indeed very smart, his ego and narcissistic personality caused him to think he was smarter than he actually was. More pressure to succeed was added on Ben when his brother excelled at school, passing his A-levels, which I think are kind of like the SATs here in the U.S., and he actually got into Cambridge University. But Ben was so arrogant and confident that he would often skip school and failed to study for his A-levels, and soon his grades began to slip. Now, despite this, he was able to eventually graduate, and he got accepted into Buckingham University with a major in English. Now, Buckingham is a great university, from what I've read, and most people would have been elated to be accepted. However, remember, Ben came from a family where you had to be the best of the best, and the fact that his older brother got accepted into one of the top colleges in the UK and he didn't infuriated him. And I mean, beyond measure. His attitude at university didn't change much from primary school, and in fact actually seemed to be getting worse, if you can imagine. Students and teachers alike began to despise him as he openly mocked, sneered, and rolled his eyes at fellow students whenever they would speak in class or answer a question. He continued to speak down to his teachers and only talked with other people when he wanted something from them. Ben would later admit in court that, feeling the pressure that he wouldn't succeed academically like his brother, he began to panic and started to create elaborate lies and ruses to tell people in order to make himself seem more successful than he actually was. And sadly, this is something he proved to be very good at. He was an extremely skilled liar, and it just seemed to come naturally to him as he created multiple different fabrications that most of his classmates and teachers started to believe. So around this time is also when he took an odd interest in elderly people. He enjoyed studying up, and when I say odd interest, I mean he enjoyed studying up on suicide, loneliness, and euthanasia in older men, and even the best way to meet and befriend older people.
He had a plan.
He had a huge plan. Just wait. He had a plan, and he also kept very detailed logs of that plan. So he enjoyed studying up on all this morbid stuff relating to older people, and he started to get the idea in his head that since he was so good at lying, he would love to try a new tactic, fooling and defrauding the elderly to not only prove how smart he was, but also to gain possible wealth and power from it, as well as not having to do much actual work.
So he's a piece of shit.
Oh, when I say he is a piece of shite, he is a huge, huge piece. And I'm about to prove that right now.
Yeah, I mean, one of the worst thing you can do is attack the elderly or prey on the elderly. I mean, that's like, you know, I'm not comparing, but the older it is, it's almost like attacking a child or something like that, depending on, you know, mental capacity and everything like that. But even that, like, older people's, man, they've earned the right to be left alone and to, like, live their life. And honestly, it's kind of sad because children at least have a parent, hopefully, that will take care of them if someone, like, takes stuff from them or does something bad to them. A lot of times, elderly people have no one. So if you take away their money, they have nothing and they can't get it back. And they don't have other people to take care of them. Not all elderly are lucky enough to have family and everything that care. And so if you're going to attack them, in a lot of ways, it's like worse than, you know, it's one of the worst things you can do, honestly.
It is. And everything you said is exactly, he was fully aware of all that. And he knew elderly people were more vulnerable, especially the ones that maybe have been suffering from illnesses or mental illnesses or diminished mental capacity, and especially the ones that didn't have family that came around or had no family at all. But what you'll learn is that money was secondary to Ben because the thing he enjoyed most was the torture, and not physical torture, but the mental torture. So in 2012, Ben began working at Red House Nursing Home in Maids Morton as a nurse's aide. However, instead of doing his job and actually helping care for the elderly patients, Ben began to emotionally and psychologically abuse them, and not only that, but to show what an absolute piece of trash this guy is, he filmed himself doing it. In several videos recorded between 2012 and 2014, Ben had his iPhone camera right in the face of a woman with dementia, and he can be heard behind the camera taunting her by saying things such as, "You're going to die alone, and no one is going to miss you. You have no friends." And I'll actually play an audio clip of it from one of the videos right here. And again, it'll piss you off. It's infuriating. So if you do think it'd be too much for you, skip ahead like 30 seconds.
"Good morning. You seem a little bit out of sorts to me. Do you feel a little bit out of sorts? You might feel confused because you've got dementia. You always used to feel sad, didn't you? And why do you think you feel sad a lot of the time? Is that because you were always lonely?
I expect so.
And do you feel lonely now?
Yes.
Sit back down. Why did you feel lonely?
Because I haven't got anybody.
You haven't got anybody? Yes. And you don't have any friends?
No.
No children? Why is that? Are you kicking that table because of the things that I'm saying? Is it because of what I'm saying, or because of yourself?
With me.
With you. It's things inside you.
Yes.
And how can we get them out?
Shut it out.
Shut it right out. Yes, that's good. And what happens next?
Kill it out.
Kill it out, yes. That's good. And what would you do to me? Touch me. What could happen next?
So on top of recording his abuse, Ben also kept extensive journals of all his exploits and his feelings of superiority. And so that's the thing, too, is like he enjoys his torture because he wants to feel superior to people, and he's too much of a chicken shit to actually try and go out and make something of himself to get into like a leader position. So he's like, I just want to feel superior by abusing people that can't fight back.
And a lady with dementia, oh, wow, you're awesome. You're so superior to an old lady with dementia.
And that's just the thing about him, is like he brags so much about how smart he is and how much more superior he is. And then the people that he's superior to are these poor old women with dementia in a nursing home he's supposed to be taking care of. So Ben would later write online that he loved working at the nursing home because he loved being around death and that it fascinated him. He also loved how nobody really questioned when an elderly person dies. So it's very clear from this point that this dude is a full-blown psychopath, and a lot of professionals feel like, above all else, Ben had to feel like he was superior to people, and that people were beneath him, and elderly people were the easiest targets for this, and that's why he enjoyed tormenting them so much.
Now, do you know if, like, when he was posting this stuff, was this during the time he was working there?
So the videos he didn't post, the videos police found on his phone later, because spoiler alert, he does get caught, but they did find, they found so much on his phone, and it's literally like a cop's wet dream, like every piece of kind of spoiler alert for later in the episode, but every possible thing they could want or need to prove him guilty, they have. So they have literal video of him abusing these old people. And he just kept it on his phone just for himself so he could watch it back and be like, haha, see how intellectually superior I am to a woman with dementia?
Okay, I was going to say, if I had witnessed someone like posting stuff like that online or even like saying things like that that worked in a nursing home, I'd report them. There's too much of this like, oh, that's not my business. I'm not going to step into it and report somebody. When you see behavior, especially where they have the opportunity to do something wrong, report them.
Exactly. Especially when it's just old people, man. Just, it's an elderly home. You took the job to take care of them. Just do your job or just leave them alone. So now during all this time, Ben is still a student at Buckingham and one day attended the class of guest lecturer Peter Farquhar. Now, remember how I said that Peter documented his first encounter with Ben in his journal? Well, Ben did the same, stating in his journal that Peter was a prime target because he was quote-unquote lonely, retired early, rattling around the house, not really doing anything, just filling his days, and literally wrote down, "It is my own ambition to exploit Peter's desire for companionship." And if you think that's bad, it gets worse. So he literally wrote it down, "I really want to exploit this guy being lonely." So Ben immediately began to lay the groundwork to get closer to Peter. After finding out that Peter was deeply religious, he began to read up on Christianity and even got a job as a church warden and started training to become a priest at Stowe Parish Church, which is the church that Peter had attended with his mother for almost his entire life. Ben would later write online that he was planning to outmaneuver the church, whatever that means. Ben uses as a chance to grow closer to Peter outside of the classroom, and he also got to get his hooks into all the other elderly churchgoers in order to gain their trust and attempt to con them, because again, he literally is training to be a priest just to do all this. So this is some next level crazy. This man is putting all this time and effort into conning people, just literally to the point where he's like, "I'm going to become a priest." And it's just kind of like, if you put half as much energy into trying to do something good or like academically, you literally could do anything you want. You could be with your brother at Cambridge right now. And speaking of his brother, let's talk about Ben's family for a bit, because during all this, his family was none the wiser. Ben's life seemed to be absolutely perfect on the outside. He was doing good at school, he was going to church and thinking of becoming a priest, and he even had a long-term girlfriend. So yeah, Shockingly, his girlfriend at this time would later state that even she was surprised when Ben asked her out, since he always seemed so aloof. But despite being a horrible, horrible human being, he was very attractive. He was an attractive man. And that makes it all the more worse because he knew he was attractive. And so he just added that to fool all these people. So he had all of them fooled, and not a single one knew the truth about what he was really up to. Not even Peter, who was instantly attracted to this handsome 20-year-old giving him attention. Ben acted extremely friendly and warm to Peter and would often sneak around to find out what book Peter was reading in order to read it also, just to give him something to talk about. On one occasion, Peter invited Ben back to his home, and the two had lunch together while discussing poetry, with Peter later writing in his journal, "Ben is so sympathetic and warm, amusing and appreciative. He's a delightful guest, and I really enjoy his company. I am glad God brought Ben into my life." Meanwhile, Ben was also writing in his journal and often wrote about the same meeting, stating, "I went over and cheered the poor man up. It was amusing. He just rattled around the house. I will exploit it." So it's tragic and disturbing because both Ben and Peter kept detailed journals throughout this whole relationship, and both get polar opposite descriptions of the exact same events. So you literally can line them up side by side and see what Ben was really doing and then how he was making Peter feel. And that, again, that just makes it even worse. Ben would often talk about his work with elderly patients at the nursing home and how he wished he could care for everyone who needed it. And he again presented himself as this handsome, smart, and kind person to a T. He literally worked with elderly people, and he exploited that too. He was like, you know, "I'm dedicating my life to taking care of these older people." And so Peter would even later write in his journal, "Please God, reward Ben for his goodness towards me and to others. He is taking his job at the care home very seriously as he helps the old people in their dementia. He is too close to death and more interested in it than he should be." So Ben was terrifyingly good at lying, and this just shows you how well he hid what a monster he was. So for over a year, Ben continued to grow close with Peter and became one of his best friends, often stopping by every day after work, you know, work, quote-unquote, when in actuality he was abusing elderly people. And the two would just sit and talk for hours, with Ben later leaving and spending his evenings at his girlfriend's house, Googling all the things Peter talked about in order to keep up the conversations going.
That just sounds exhausting, too.
And again, if you put that much effort into your schooling or a trade or literally anything, you could conquer the world, essentially. You could literally do whatever you wanted, and you choose it to be one of the most absolute scumbags in the world.
And could you imagine being the poor girlfriend that's sitting around while this guy's just, like, Googling stuff to talk to, like, an old man that he's trying to con?
And that does come up a little bit later, because he does eventually move in with Peter, but and he's still dating a girl. But he has an explanation for that. That's the thing. He is that good of a liar. He has an explanation for everything. And usually it's pretty convincing. Because again, why would you not believe him anyway? Who would lie about that? This handsome, going to school, taking care of elderly people. That's someone you trust. That's not someone who lies. So in either late 2012 or early 2013, Ben decided that he had secured a good place in Peter's life and that it was time to move forward with phase two. Ben stated that he was looking to move to a new place, somewhere quiet, and a place where he could focus on his studies and peace. And it was at this point, Peter offered to let Ben move in with him, and Ben agreed. Peter gave Ben a key to the house to come and go as he pleased, and by October of 2013, Ben was ready to move forward to phase three of his plan. It was around this time that Ben finally, quote-unquote, confessed to Peter that he loved him more than just a friend, and that he wanted to be with him. Now, of course, this confession was a dream come true for Peter, who by this point was madly in love with Ben, and he saw Ben as the answer to the prayers he had been asking God for years. Someone who could spend his final years with, and he wouldn't have to die alone. Now, what makes this even more sad and tragic is that due to his life of celibacy and lack of romantic relationships, Peter was less experienced in romance than honestly most teenagers or preteens. And so he had zero knowledge that this type of situation may be shady or a red flag, or to know you just kind of proceed with caution with it. Because again, Peter was in his 60s and Ben was 23 at the time Ben moved in. But now, of course, nothing wrong with two consenting adults being in a relationship together whatsoever. However, most people would probably approach this with caution, as there is the obvious threat that the younger person may be trying to take advantage of the older person, usually for money, which is exactly what Ben was doing. But Peter didn't even consider this at all, as all he could think about at that moment was how his dreams had finally come true and God had answered his prayers. Peter wrote in his journal later that night, "I didn't think it was possible. Ben can love me. A miracle if there ever was one." Just a few months after confessing his love for Peter, on January 3rd, 2014, Peter's 68th birthday, Ben asked Peter to marry him.
Oh, wow. That's moving fast, too.
Very fast. So, Ben's like, you know, I've got him wrapped around my finger, and we all know what he wants. He wants the damn will. So, now again, Peter wrote in his journal stating, "He asked me with great beauty if we could be betrothed, and I accepted with all my heart." Now, one thing about the relationship that Peter loved was that Ben seemed to push him to give in to his homosexual urges and challenged him on balancing his fate with his love for another man, and Peter loved that Ben seemed to do both so easily, never knowing that Ben wasn't even gay and was still in a relationship with a girl at this time, and she knew he was living with Peter. However, Ben told her that he moved in to help take care of Peter in his older age, and so he spun it as, you know, this is one of my favorite teachers from school. He has no one, so I'm moving in to help take care of him and just make sure he's got everything he needs. And that just made people love him more. Like, oh, this selfless man, he's taking care of his favorite teacher, and he's just so selfless and caring, not knowing this is one of the most sadistic people to ever walk the earth. So the two had a betrothing ceremony in March of 2014 in London, with Peter writing, "It was one of the happiest days of my life. Gone are the fears of dying alone." Ben also wrote about this betrothal ceremony in his journal, and he stated, "He doesn't know we have a deal. I will pay for nothing and continue to hang out with him until he dies and I get everything. Win-win. I'm comfortable with his death." He then ended that day's journal by calling Peter a faggot. So that really shows you, Ben spent 4 years of his life, like, webbing his way into Peter's life to the point they live together, they go on vacations together. Peter introduces Ben to his family, his brother, and, like, all this. And even to this point, Ben's still like, "I literally could not care less about this man. I just want his money."
I wonder, you know, did they get romantic? Is there at least a little kissing and stuff like that? Because that would be a huge red flag. And if, I mean, this guy's fully committed if he's going to go that far to bilk money out of this man.
But remember, this was like the ideal situation for Ben, because Peter was celibate his whole life. And he still, even though, so Peter wanted more than anything just someone to spend his final days with. It wasn't, I don't think, so much the sexual aspect of it. He just wanted someone who was there for him.
He wanted companionship, not romance.
Yeah, he wanted companionship, not romance. And so I think he was content not having sex or doing anything like that, because it kind of worked out for him. Like, he could still be true to his fate. He's not having sexual relationships with men, but he gets to have a companion that's there for him and that loves to spend time with him. And honestly, that was a perfect situation for Ben too, because he was like, "I'm conning this man to marrying me and I don't even have to touch him." So it's just one of those horrible, horrible perfect storm of a situation, and sadly it does not end well. But now betrothed and living with Peter full time, Ben wrote that he was excited to, quote unquote, have fun with Peter, and by that he meant he was excited to start his torment and gaslighting of Peter, as that was his ultimate goal. The money and the potential inheritance he would eventually get was a nice bonus, but his main enjoyment came from the torment and sense of power he had over the older man. Now, not long after the betrothal, Ben began to steal sedatives and other drugs from his job at the nursing home. He began to slip them into Peter's food, making him drowsy and incoherent, and causing him to have periods of blackouts. During these times when Peter was drugged and out of it, Ben took the time to gaslight and mess with Peter's head. He would delete contacts from Peter's phone, he would hide certain pieces of clothing, hide his keys, hide the book he was reading, etc. Ben wrote that he got great joy from watching Peter come to and become extremely confused as to what happened or where everything was. When asked why he did it later in court, Ben stated, "For no other reason than that it was cruel, to upset and to torment Peter out of meanness." Ben wrote in his journal that his ultimate goal was to get Peter to change his will and make Ben the sole inheritor, and in November 2014, Peter did just that. Although he didn't leave everything to Ben, he made it to where he would inherit half of everything on top of a $20,000 settlement. The reason Peter did this was because Ben began to gaslight and convince Peter that those periods of Ben drugging him were actually signs that his health was declining and he could possibly die soon and that he needed to get his affairs in order. However, Peter also made sure to add a stipulation to his will in which Ben could not inherit the house unless he lived in it for 2 years. Now, of course, that infuriated Ben because he would not accept that. He wanted to sell it, take the cash, and move on to his next victim. So he later wrote in his journal that his goal for 2015 was to, and I quote, "end Peter and put him in a hole." Ben also wrote how he was excited to keep gaslighting and drugging Peter for fun. So beginning in 2015, Ben would drug Peter on at least 50 separate occasions. He started with the sedatives and tranquilizers he stole from work, but eventually moved on to drugging Peter with hallucinogenics, which caused terrifying hallucinations. Ben made sure to do this whenever the two would go out in public because he also enjoyed publicly humiliating Peter. So the two would go out and the drugs would cause Peter to slur his words, fall asleep, and kind of act out of it and incoherent. And Ben began to tell everyone that Peter had developed an alcohol problem and that he was drunk. He began to post about how much he wanted to help Peter, but how his drinking was only growing worse and worse. The drugs made Peter so out of it that on several occasions he would pass out or fall over and seriously injure himself, like giving himself a black eye. And it was at this point he realized something was very wrong with him. But he still had no idea that Ben was the one drugging him, writing in his journal, "I've been feeling tired for a few weeks and occasionally lost my balance. Ben has been so kind." So at this point, I should tell y'all that on top of being a disgusting monster, Ben was also a wannabe rapper. He loved writing raps and recording himself rapping them. And around this time, he wrote some lyrics and recorded himself rapping to them. And, well, the entire thing is about how he is murdering Peter. So I'll actually going to play a clip of it. I'm going to play a clip of him rapping here for you guys. And I'll just let you guys figure it out because I literally don't have words.
"So I'm killing this man. Is it fantasize? Fantasize about it since the faggot tried to go against me. And now it's time for a crimson tide. And I'm the king. And I will reside on the throne. And you know that I will kill this guy."
And so if the lyrics were a little hard to hear, I'm going to read some of them to you. They go, "'Cause I'm killing this man. Fantasies, fantasies about it. Since the fag tried to go against me, it's time for the crimson tide. And I am the king. I will reside on the throne. And you know that I can kill this guy." So on top of all his detailed logs about how he's going to end Peter, put him in a hole, gaslight him, how he only wants him for his money, he's also rapping about murdering him. This is that guy that's superior to everyone intellectually, but he is leaving the biggest evidence trail, I think, known to man. So on top of all this, Ben also recorded himself gaslighting Peter like he did with the elderly patients at his job. And in one instance, in a video found on Ben's phone released by police, Ben records Peter talking not long after drugging him, and Peter is bedridden. Now, by July of 2015, Ben began to increase the amount of drugs he was giving Peter to the point where Peter began to have night terrors and began writing in his journal about how he was losing his mind, stating, "I awoke to see black insects. Something terrible has entered my brain." Peter's friends became concerned when in August of 2015, Peter attended a book signing for his latest book, and there he appeared to be out of it, slurring his words, terrified, and falling asleep. Ben sadly informed them that Peter's drinking had gotten worse. Peter went to several doctors to try and figure out what was going on, but none of them could figure anything out as they all stated Peter was perfectly healthy. Ben began to suggest that Peter may be experiencing early signs of dementia, and knowing that Peter was terrified of losing his mind, began to actually suggest to Peter that the best course of action may be for him to take his own life. So, he was like, maybe I can get Peter to do the work for me. I don't have to do anything, and then I'm really not responsible for killing him. Peter, however, stated he did not want to die, and he dropped the issue, and it's at this point that Ben set out to murder Peter. His first attempt was on October 3rd, 2015. He again drugged Peter and then plied him with alcohol before pushing him down the stairs in an attempt to kill him. Now, Peter survived the fall, having been found unconscious by his cleaner. He was taken to the hospital where, thanks to the drugs, he was unable to remember anything, and this led doctors to initially think that it was a suicide attempt. Ben had failed to kill Peter, and this infuriated him. So this leads us back to where we started the episode. Peter is found dead at his home on October 26, next to an empty bottle of whiskey. The coroner states that his death was due to acute alcohol consumption, and it was ruled an accident. Peter is buried next to his mom in the cemetery, and Ben receives half of everything, including Peter's house and $20,000 to boot, and he believed he had gotten away with murder. He would later write in his diary, "I hated you all along. This is my house now. The police believed me." Ben took the money he got from selling Peter's house and bought himself a flat in London. Now, although Ben never revealed how Peter actually died, police believe that after drugging Peter, Ben smothered him with a pillow, which is why there was no sign of a struggle. Following Peter's death, Ben had gone away with murder. Like, he legitimately got away with it. He got what he wanted, and no one suspected a thing. If he had stopped there, then he never would have been caught, and Peter would never have gotten justice.
People like that never know when to stop.
Never. Because being such a narcissistic prick, there was no way Ben was going to stop now, and he set out to choose his next victim, and boy, did it not take long. Within a month of Peter's death, Ben began to visit and befriend 81-year-old Ann Moore Martin, who lived just two houses down from Peter. The two were already somewhat acquainted after being introduced to each other by Peter, and like Peter, Anne was a retired school teacher, very religious, and had no spouse or kids, and was very lonely. Peter began to move faster with Anne than he had with Peter. He began to stop by her house for lunch or slip notes to her through her mailbox, and within just a few months, he confessed that he was starting to fall in love with Anne. In one note he wrote Anne, he stated, "I desire you, and I desire to woo you. It's my earnest hope that you see me as I see you. You are beautiful and faithful to God. I would love to take away your tiredness, your loneliness, and I know I could if you allow it. Your loneliness needs to be replaced with my company." Now, of course, Anne was quickly smitten with a handsome young man coming around her house all the time because, again, like Peter, she was lonely and she just didn't want to be alone in her final years. Once gaining Anne's affection, Ben quickly began to turn up the gaslighting. But he set about it a different way compared to what he did with Peter. So he actually began to write messages all over the mirrors in Anne's home and then tell her that he didn't write them and that it must mean God himself wrote the messages. Some of these messages read, "All that you give him, he will return in tenfold. And pray for Ben. Ben loves you. And your intentions are holy. Take care and complete the task given to you by your Lord." And do you want to know how police know this?
Because they were on his phone.
because Ben took photos and videos of himself writing the messages on the mirror. Ben convinced Anne that he needed to borrow money from her to buy a new car because his broke down, and after she gave him the money, he went out, rented a car, drove it back to Anne's to show her his new car that she bought for him, and then immediately returned it to the dealership and then pocketed the money. A few months after that, he told Anne that his brother had been diagnosed with kidney failure and that they desperately needed money to buy a new dialysis machine for him. He convinced Anne to withdraw all the money from her accounts and give it to him to pay for his brother's treatment. Later in court, when asked what he did with the money Anne had given him, he chuckled and said, "Well, I certainly didn't buy a dialysis machine. I spent it." Now, although Anne didn't have any kids, she did have a niece and other family that she was close with and often talked to and spent time with, and Ben convinced her not to tell any of them about him because they, quote-unquote, they would never understand our love. So by the end of 2016, Ben had begun drugging Anne like he did with Peter. However, the drugs had a different effect on Anne. They began to cause her to have violent seizures, which resulted in her going to the hospital on at least two separate occasions. Now, of course, Anne's family began catching wind that this strange man was in her home every time she had a medical emergency, and pretty soon several of them started growing suspicious of him. The second time she ended up in the hospital following a seizure, Anne confessed everything to her niece, telling her about Ben, the messages from God, and giving Ben the money for his dying brother. Now, of course, her niece immediately knew something was wrong and contacted police to investigate. Of course, Anne was tested and found to have several sedatives in her system she had no knowledge of taking, and that was enough to get warrants to search Ben Field's flat. Now, do you think those extensive journals Ben kept detailing every step of his torture and murder of Peter would ever come up again or play a major role in his conviction?
I'm pretty sure they will, and I'm pretty sure knowing the type of person this guy is, he didn't even try to hide these things.
Yeah, because if you thought that his journals would come into play later on in court, you'd be right, but Ben sure as shit didn't, because they were laying right out in the open for police to find.
I told you.
And of course, police quite literally had everything they needed literally right there in black and white. Ben was quickly arrested for the attempted murder of Anne, the murder of Peter, and for fraud charges. He pleaded not guilty to murder and attempted murder, but he did plead guilty to fraud. Now, his trial began in May 2019 at Oxford Crown Court, and it lasted 10 weeks as they went over every single piece of evidence. During all this, despite pleading not guilty to murder, Ben was very open about his hatred for Peter, his indifference to Anne, and how he enjoyed tormenting them both for fun. Now, of course, you can imagine this did not go over well with anyone on the jury. And on August 9th, 2019, they found Ben Field guilty of murder in the case of Peter Farquhar, and they sentenced him to life in prison with a minimum of 36 years to be served. Sadly, there was not enough physical evidence to convict him for Anne's attempted murder, and those charges were dropped. However, this is still one of the longest sentences in UK history for a single count of murder. He has appealed his sentence twice, but both times has been denied and will probably continue to be denied. Anne sadly passed away from natural causes in 2017, and the flat Ben bought with the money he stole from Peter was sold, and the money was returned to Peter's family, who were finally able to rest knowing that Peter had finally received justice. Ben continues to sit and rot in jail, and I still can't believe what a psychopath and how sadistic this man is.
The thing is, when he gets out of jail, he is not going to be a changed man. You don't change from this.
If he does get out of jail, like I said, he has to serve a minimum of 36 years. He will get out in his early 60s, which will put him right about the age Peter was when Ben started manipulating him. And so hopefully he never gets out, though, because that's just... I was infuriated reading all this, especially the thing that got me the most was the two journals, like Peter's journal and Ben's journal. Like reading Peter's journal, and it's like, you know, I had another fainting spell. Doctors don't know what's wrong, but Ben's been so kind. He's been right by my side and taking care of me. And then literally in the next room, Ben's writing down like, ha ha ha, he doesn't know I'm drugging him. I hate him. Like, I'm going to get all his money soon when I kill him. It's just so infuriating knowing, like, you knowingly took so much advantage of this person who did love you. Even if it wasn't in a sexual way, he genuinely just wanted your friendship. And you couldn't even give that to him. So, yeah, this was a really interesting case to read about because I haven't really honestly seen it covered a lot. But it was an infuriating case. Thankfully, Peter and Anne got justice. And Ben's locked away, and hopefully he'll continue to be locked away. And with that, thank you guys so much for tuning in for another week. Thank you to our listener who suggested this case in the first place. And again, if any of you guys have any suggestions for cases you want us to cover, or just cases that you want us to hear us cover, like in general, shoot us a message over on Instagram at Beers with Queers Pod, that's P-O-D, or on Facebook at Beers with Queers, a true crime podcast. Please leave us a 5-star rating or review on iTunes or Spotify. Helps us out a lot and helps other people discover the podcast. And again, we just love hearing from you guys, whether it be positive or negative, hopefully positive. And until Monday, stay dangerous out there, my friend.
See you soon.
Bye.